Hi folks, just a couple of short announcements before we begin this podcast. First off, I want to say thank you to everyone who has donated to the Patreon. It's gotten off to a great start, and I'll be making sure to fill the Patreon page with content this month. For those still interested in donating the price of a coffee or pint to support the continuation of this podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Second, I want to give a shout out to Sinead and her podcast Mens Rhea. It's a true crime podcast dealing with cases in the UK and Ireland. Here's a short promo.
Mens Rhea is the legal principle of criminal intent. It means literally the guilty mind. Join me, Sinead, every fortnight to discuss Ireland and the UK's most heinous crimes and the court cases that followed. Do you want to know more about a kink killing in Dublin in 2012? Or serial killers in Scotland? Whatever your guilty pleasure, you'll find it and all the details with me. Find Mens Rhea wherever you get your podcasts.
That's definitely one I recommend checking out if you're interested in true crime. Now, back to the episode, which is all about the 1983 Mays prison escape. Mays prison was seen by many as Europe's most secure prison. It was a prison within a detention centre within an army camp, and believed to be completely impenetrable by any one prisoner. That was until September in 1983, when the IRA successfully pulled off the largest prison escape in British and Irish history. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Mays Prison was opened in 1971, after the RUC and British Army had introduced Operation Demetrius in Northern Ireland. This saw the mass arrest and internment of 350 Northern Irish people suspected of being involved with the IRA. This policy of internment without trial would continue until 1975. It turned out that many of those detained in this first wave of arrests had little to no connection with the IRA. The main IRA suspects had been tipped off and managed to avoid arrests, and it is believed that the soldiers used wrong or out-of-date information when making these arrests. The mass arrest caused a huge amount of violence and anger in the nationalist community, and there have been claims that the soldiers smashed their way into the people's homes without warning. There were 4 days of clashes in which 20 civilians, 2 IRA members, and 2 British soldiers were killed. Those who were arrested were held without trial in Nissen Huts, which are an army-style barracks at a disused Royal Air Force airfield, which became the Long Kesh Detention Centre. The huts were makeshift structures and were not suitable for long-term detainment. The centre was then renamed to Her Majesty's Prison Mays, as they were situated in the township of Mays. And in 1976, 8 new blocks were added to the prison, known as H blocks, as they were all shaped like the capital letter H. These would specifically house those convicted of scheduled terrorist offences. There were loyalists arrested too, but they were the minority, and by 1975, there were 1,981 people in the maze, with 107 of them being loyalists. The rest were Republicans. Each block housed 4 self-contained prisons, called wings. The wings were then controlled in what was known as the circle, or centre of the H. There was a 15-foot fence surrounding the entire prison, and each H block was surrounded by a 5.5-metre-high concrete wall, with barbed wire at the top. All of the gates on the compound were made of solid steel and were electronically operated. The entire prison was considered impenetrable. IRA and INLA members who were arrested viewed themselves as prisoners of war, and that it was their duty to escape. They also refused to be treated as regular inmates and fought for special category status, which would mean that they didn't have to wear uniforms or do prison work as well as other things. Inmates in Northern Ireland had been granted this status in 1972, but it was subsequently revoked in 1976 by Labour Party Secretary of State Merlin Rees. Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister in 1979 and doubled down on the policy. Here she is arguing that there is no excuse for violence. There is no such thing as political murder, political bombing, or political violence. There is only criminal murder, criminal bombing, and criminal violence. We will not compromise on this. There will be no political status. Prisoners arriving at Mays Prison after March of 1976 would not be granted special category status. This led to a huge outcry by Republicans who were there. By 1978, nearly 300 Republicans refused to wear their prison uniforms, opting to wear the blankets from their beds instead. The British government refused to back down, and the Republicans then began a dirty protest, covering the walls of their cells with excrement. Prisoner Pat McGeown described the conditions in his cell. Quote, "There were times when you would vomit. There were times when you were so run down that you would lie for days and not do anything with the maggots crawling all over you. The rain would be coming in the window and you'd be lying there with the maggots all over the place." Outside of the maze, the IRA Army Council began to communicate with IRA prisoners who asked them to start assassinating prison officers. Over the five-year period that these strikes took place within the prison, 19 prison officers were killed on the outside. Then, in 1981, the prisoners began a hunger strike that would see 10 men losing their lives. One of them was Bobby Sands, who will be covered in a later episode. That brings us to 1983. The Nationalist prisoners deeply resented the prison system and wanted to continue to undermine the authority of the British government, and began to plot what would become the largest mass breakout in the history of Ireland and the United Kingdom. Prisoner and IRA member Larry Marley was selected to lead the escape. He had some experience with escapes in the past and seemed to be the perfect choice for the job. In 1975, he and nine other IRA men escaped from a courthouse in the town of Newry. He was recaptured in 1977. Then, in 1978, he nearly escaped Mays Prison while dressed as a prison warden, but was captured before reaching the prison perimeter. After this failed attempt, he then joined the blanket protests for the next 4 years, but he had not given up on escaping the maze. Marley was aided by a number of other nationalists, including Bobby Storey, Jerry Kelly, and Brendan McFarlane. There was an escape officer selected from each block, as well as intelligence officers who would try and learn as much about the layout of the prison as possible. Those involved in the attempt were also only told exactly what they needed to know, so that very few people knew the entire plan. Their first priority was to learn about the prison and its structure. Though they had been imprisoned there, many of them had no idea how the prison actually looked from the outside. One inmate recalls how the wardens were careful never to reveal the layout of the prison to the prisoners. Quote, "It was a very large camp, and when the screws would move you from one place to another, they would move you in blacked out vans. They had a policy of providing you with a most limited view of the jail." When they say screw in this context, they're referring to the prison officers. In this way, the prisoners had no idea where they were positioned in the maze. Visiting family members started to smuggle in aerial photographs that had been taken by the media, as well as ordnance survey maps. The most important part of this breakout attempt was the prison officers themselves. It was very important to understand the prison officers and build a camaraderie with them, so as to establish their weaknesses. During the years of the blanket protests, dirty protests, and hunger strikes, there was a deep-seated hatred between prison officer and prisoner. To make the escape possible, the IRA had to change that. Prisoners began calling the officers by their first names, and trying to take the tension out of the relationship between prisoner and guard. Some nationalists found this very difficult and had a hard time treating the officers as equals, as the hunger strike had taken place just 2 years before. But gradually the plan began to work. According to some of the inmates there, the officers began to believe that they had broken them. Other officers remained suspicious and were reluctant to let their guard down. Some of the prisoners also became orderlies, where they would sweep and polish so that they could get access to different parts of the prison. The orderlies would talk about football to the guards and make them tea. As they engaged in idle chit-chat, the guards would reveal small bits of information about the prison, shift changes, when it's busy, and so on. The orderlies soon found themselves positioned in places they shouldn't be, such as the control room of the H7 block, in full view of security camera feeds. They would clean and polish the area while learning information that would help in their eventual escape. Though the door to this area was meant to remain closed and padlocked, the officers left it open as it would let fresh air into the room, and because they didn't feel as threatened by the prisoners. The prisoners meticulously planned each stage of their escape. Diagrams were made showing different alarm points around the prison where the guards could raise the alarm. The plan had to be perfect, as it would be shown to the IRA on the outside, who would approve it. If they weren't happy, they could call it off. Once the plan was approved, the IRA then set about smuggling guns into the prison. The prisoners needed the guards to immediately surrender, and the only way to do that would be by using guns. 6 handguns were smuggled into the prison, and to this day, the IRA has not revealed exactly how they managed to get them in. By this stage, they had planned how to take control of the H7 block, but then needed to figure out how to get out of the rest of May's prison. It was incredibly secure, with long high fences and many layers between the inmates and the exit. There was no chance of scaling the fences or digging under them, though the IRA did try to dig under the fences in a previous attempt. There was also an armed British soldier stationed at a watchtower by the main gate. The prisoners eventually focused their efforts on the transport that had been coming in and out of the prison, and in particular, the prison food truck. It travelled in and out of the maze, but also to each and every block of the prison. The prisoners also found out that the truck wasn't searched as it entered or exited the compound. The guards at the gate knew the driver's face, and they never felt the need to search the vehicle. Now they just needed to figure out how to take control of it. After months of preparation, the prisoners had amassed a huge amount of information. They knew how to take over a block and how to secure it without the alarm going off. They also knew what time the food lorry arrived at and were confident that they could hijack it and hide in the back. They also knew that the lorry would not be searched. On the 25th of September, 1983, the plan was in motion. It was a Sunday afternoon, which was a deliberate choice by the inmates. Inmate Brendan McFarlane recalls, "The reason we chose a Sunday was because Sunday is a closed day. There's no visits, there's no movement inside the prison other than food lorries up and down, or somebody going to the hospital. There's no workshops, there's no football, there's nothing. You observe Sunday like a religious day almost. Therefore, they also do not need the same amount of staff as they would on a normal working day." The day began with McFarlane covertly taking the names of all the officers in the block. The prisoners needed 12 officers' uniforms to pull off this escape attempt, and needed to match the prisoner with the officer whose clothes they would steal. The code word for the beginning of the operation was Bumper, which was the machine used to polish the floors. Once the prisoners heard McFarlane shouting for this, then the attempt was on. Once Bumper was shouted, a 90-second countdown began, beginning with the group silently capturing 4 officers who were gathered in one room. When discussing the level of aggression they would use, the group decided to use extreme verbal aggression, which would hopefully prevent them from having to use the firearms. This escape attempt was as much about portraying the IRA in a positive light as it was about getting the inmates out of the prison. And if they were to kill officers, it would tarnish their portrayal in the media. They were prepared to do it, but they were trying to avoid it. Bobby Story entered the room with 4 prison officers. He and another prisoner then produced the guns and pointed them at the heads of the officers, but also while being quiet so as not to alert other officers outside. Story held his gun up and cocked it to prove it was real, and then demanded that the officers get down on the ground. The first 4 had been taken. There were still 17 more officers scattered around H Block that needed to be dealt with, and they all had to be taken simultaneously or as close to as possible. Everything during this attempt operated on line of sight, so once one officer was taken, then that was the cue for the prisoner down the hall to take the next one. But the most important job of all was getting to the officer in the control room in the centre of the block. The officer would sit in this room beside an intercom, a panic button, a radio, and a telephone. Prison officer John Adams was assigned to the control room on this day. This was a problem for the inmates, as Adams was one of the only officers they believed would create difficulty if they tried to overpower him. Another problem was that there was a metal barred door between the prisoners and Adams. Jerry Kelly approached Adams and pointed a gun through the bars at him and said, "Don't fucking move. Get on the ground. This is an IRA operation. If you move, I'll shoot. If you do what I tell you, you won't be hurt. If anyone phones here and asks what the problem is, you then take 30 seconds, and whatever the problem is, you go back to him and say, 'Look, that's been sorted.'" Adams then said, "What if they don't believe me?" To which Kelly responded, "You make them believe you." At this moment, the prisoners were then surprised by a prison officer who came out of the ladies' toilets. He was quickly overpowered, but Adams used this distraction to try and raise the alarm. Kelly responded by firing 2 shots at Adams. One of them hit him above the eye and knocked him unconscious. He woke up 30 seconds later and had a conversation with Kelly, who said, "What did you do that for?" Adams responded, saying he didn't know. He was bleeding heavily at this point, but ultimately survived the attack. All the officers who were captured were then brought into a classroom with their hands tied behind their backs and pillowcases placed on their heads so as not to identify any of the prisoners. 12 of them were then stripped and the prisoners put on their uniforms. The prisoners then read a statement saying, "This is an IRA operation. We're not here for revenge or to punish you over the hunger strikes, but if you interfere with the escape, you will be dealt with swiftly." By 2:50 p.m., H7 was now completely controlled by the IRA in an operation that took 20 minutes. But they were not free yet. They still had a long way to go to get out of Mays Prison. 30 minutes later, David McLaughlin arrived in the food delivery truck that the prisoners needed for the escape. McLaughlin was essential for the escape because the officers recognized his face coming in and out of the prison. He was captured and held at gunpoint. Bobby Story then said to him, "This block is now in the hands of the IRA. All screws who obeyed our orders are safe. One who didn't was shot in the head. We will shoot anyone who endangers our planned escape, including you." Bobby then motioned to Jerry Kelly and said to the driver, "That man will remain with you throughout the escape. He is doing 30 years and he'll shoot you without hesitation if he has to. He has nothing to lose." 37 prisoners were then loaded into the back of the food truck and Kelly climbed into the footwell beside the driver and kept a gun pointed at him. He also told the driver that there was a grenade under his seat that would explode if he tried anything. There wasn't really a grenade, but seeing the prisoners with guns made this threat significantly more believable. The lorry then began to drive away from H Block and towards the exit route of the prison. They now had to try and take over the control room of the main gate, which was also known as the Tally Lodge. It was here that officers clocked in and out of their shifts. The plan was simple: take over the Tally Lodge and open the gate, allowing the prisoners to escape. It was also agreed that a number of prisoners would stay behind to watch the officers until the 38 had escaped. Kelly's role at this point was to stay with the driver McLaughlin and make sure that he didn't drive away in the lorry. At one point, Kelly asked him how much he earns, to which McLaughlin responded, "Not fucking enough." 12 prisoners disguised as prison officers went into the Tally Lodge and started to arrest the other officers. One of them recalls getting captured by the prisoners. Quote, "I didn't know what to make of it. The last thing I thought of was the provost. Never thought they'd get the hell there. I seen a prisoner I recognized and I said to Keith, 'Keep quiet, this is the provost.' Then my heart started and I thought I was going to burst out of my chest." Just a quick note that the provost is a slang term for the provisional IRA. The phone then started ringing in the Tally Lodge. The prisoners brought a senior officer over to the phone to answer it. They stood beside him with guns pointed at him and said, "Answer the phone. If you say a wrong word, it will be your last." The emergency control room were the ones calling, as an alarm had been triggered in the Tally Lodge and they wanted to make sure everything was okay. It turns out that there was a hidden alarm button under the television in the Tally Lodge that one of the hostages had pressed. The senior officer just said it was a mistake, and then the person on the other end of the line told him to stop messing about and to reset the alarm. There were now 24 officers arrested and only 12 prisoners holding them. The timing of the escape had been delayed, and the prisoners arrived at the tally lodge during a shift change, where officers were arriving to clock in or out. Each was arrested as they arrived, but the prisoners soon began to become overwhelmed with the amount of officers they had to arrest. It wasn't long before the officers began to start fighting back, and the prisoners began to lose control of the tally lodge. Outside, the main gate was opened, and most of the prisoners were still in the lorry, waiting for the ones in the tally lodge to join them. But two officers managed to wedge their cars in the gate, blocking the lorry from escaping. The back of the lorry was then opened, and the prisoners all flooded out and began fighting with the officers who had freed themselves. During the fighting, five officers were stabbed. During all this commotion, there was an armed British soldier in the guard tower above them. He watched the entire scene unfold, but didn't know who to shoot, as many of the prisoners were dressed as officers. It later emerged that he believed that it was prison staff fighting each other. The prisoners ran towards the final gate and climbed over it as the officers chased them. One officer was shot in the leg as he chased the prisoners. By 4:18 p.m., it was all over. Three prisoners had been captured while trying to escape, and 35 had breached the perimeter of the prison. This had been the biggest prison escape in Europe since World War II. Outside, there was a plan for an IRA convoy to meet and collect the members. But due to a miscalculation in timing, there was no one there, so the prisoners fled across fields or hijacked passing cars. It wasn't long before news got out of this escape.
Mass escape from the maze. A prison officer killed, more than 20 Republicans on the run.
En Irlande du Nord, une vingtaine de prisonniers se sont échappés de la prison de haute sécurité.
The fields and hedgerows around the jail have been bristling with heavily armed soldiers.
In the wake of the escape, 20 prison officers were injured. 13 were kicked or beaten, 4 were stabbed, and 2 were shot. One officer, James Ferris, suffered a heart attack after being stabbed and died. A number of escapees were later tried for his murder, but were eventually acquitted after the judge concluded that it could not be proved that the stabbing caused the heart attack which killed him. The army and RUC were quick to respond, and within 10 minutes of the prisoners escaping the prison, checkpoints had been established around the prison and on some major roads in Northern Ireland. Once the prisoners made it outside of the prison, it was every man for himself. Of the 35 escapees, 15 were recaptured on the same day. Story, McFarlane and Kelly split into three teams. A number of cars were hijacked before they headed in different locations. Some headed towards the border to the Republic of Ireland, and hoped to hide out across the border. Others avoided the roads completely and kept to the countryside, crossing rivers and fields. Once they got to a safe house, some IRA members were given the option to move to America and assume new identities, while others were offered the chance to resume paramilitary activity. Story and a group of prisoners were eventually caught while hiding in a river and were brought back to Maze. Kelly and his group made their way to a nationalist housing estate in Lurgan, a town 14 miles away from Maze. They then hid out in an IRA weapon stash, which was a tiny crawl space between two floors. There they would listen to updates about the escape on the radio. It was very tight and they had to lie down at all times and couldn't even turn over without their shoulders hitting the floorboards. They were there for over 2 weeks. McFarlane and his group broke into a house where they intended to hide out. There was a family in the house that were held hostage for a short while. When McFarlane and the group were leaving, the entire family swore on a Bible that they would not call the police until 72 hours after the men left. The group then spent 3 days walking through fields to an IRA stronghold in South Armagh. 2 months after the escape, escapee Kieran Fleming drowned while trying to escape from an SAS ambush while in the process of planting a bomb. Another escapee, Jer McDonnell, was arrested in Glasgow during the arrest of the Brighton Hotel bomber, Pat McGee, which has been covered in an earlier episode. Kelly and McFarlane ended up spending months living in the Republic of Ireland. Then, in January 1984, they flew to mainland Europe using false passports. There, they continued their work with the IRA under these new identities. They were eventually arrested in the Netherlands and extradited back to Maze Prison in 1986. Of the 38 escapees, Gerard Fryers and Seamus Campbell were never heard from again. The escape made headlines around the world and was a major security embarrassment to the British Army. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher made a statement saying, "It is a very, very grave incident indeed, the most serious in our prison history." The governor of Maze Prison resigned and an inquiry was commissioned called the Hennessy Inquiry. I'll leave the link to the full inquiry in the show notes, but essentially the inquiry placed the blame on the prison staff, as well as the overall design of the prison itself. James Hennessy, who wrote the report, went on to say that the key weakness was in the main gate of the prison. The main gate was controlled by people in, quote, "a rather flimsy wooden building to which anyone could have access from inside the prison." He also concluded that the control room in the centre of H Block was not operational as it should have been. The control room is where all the communication and monitoring equipment was in each block. It was designed in such a way that once the officer was in there, there was a closed bulletproof door and then a closed metal bar door. In this way, it should have been impenetrable. But when all the doors were closed, there was no airflow in this room, and the officers found it very difficult to remain in there for long periods of time. So, they left the bulletproof door open. There was a very relaxed atmosphere with the prisoners, so the officers didn't feel worried about them prior to the escape. Maze Prison eventually closed its doors after the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998. And in the 2 years following the agreement, 428 prisoners were released. Nowadays, the site lies derelict, and there are still some small sections of the prison visible, but most has been demolished. There were plans for a peace centre to be built on the site, but it is unlikely this will go ahead after disagreements between Sinn Féin and the DUP. Part of the site is now known as Balmoral Park, which is an outdoor events venue. Irish Republicans referred to the escape as the Great Escape, and it was a major morale boost for the IRA at the time. Though mastermind Larry Marley planned the escape, he stayed behind on the day, because his release date was coming up soon. Marley was released in 1986 and was shot dead by the UVF less than a year later. That's it for this episode. I used many sources in this writing, but if you'd like to see a depiction of the escape, I'd recommend the 2017 film Maze. I believe it's available to rent on YouTube. Thanks, and see you next time.